certified both in family medicine and preventive medicine. He currently serves as the medical officer of the health at the Fraser Health Authority and adjunct lecturer in global health and clinical public health at the University of Toronto. The research presented here was conducted during his time as a medical specialist in vaccine safety at the Public Health Agency of Canada. He is also honored to be the 2013 APHA award recipient of the J. Drotman Award. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming and spending your lunch hour with the three of us talking about cancer care and alike. I'm coming at this specific area more from a public health background, and being a public health physician, I throughout my training had very little exposure to pharmacovigilance and vaccine vigilance. So when I actually took up my position with the federal government and was advised that I had been posted in the vaccine safety division, I was kind of like, well, isn't vaccine safety and pharmacovigilance kind of like the Titanic? Everyone knows how this ends. Like, you know, I was like, if we really like vaccines and we really like drugs, we believe they work, and we, you know, the numbers are going to show that. So I assumed it was like going to a movie where you know what the ending is. But I think especially with this specific vaccine, which is what my supervisor, Barb Law, suggested to look at, and Gardasil particularly being very controversial, I think it's important for us to actually have the data and the statistics to at least support our public health efforts in having this vaccine rolled out. And so this is essentially the Canadian experience with Gardasil and the APHES that we have. Before I go on, I actually flipped my outline and my disclosure side. So I have no relevant financial relationships to disclose. And this is a brief outline just of our presentation, which I'll get to right now. So again, with regards to coming up with vaccine, looking at the safety of Gardasil vaccine, it really is helpful for me to give you guys maybe a bit of background on vaccine safety in general. Vaccine safety in Canada is monitored similarly as in the United States. I think many of you who do work in public health in the U.S. will be familiar with VAERS, which is the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. In Canada, we have our own database known as CAFIS, which is the Canadian Adverse Event Following Immunization Surveillance System. It was established in 1987 and had these as the following objectives. But essentially what it is, it's supposed to basically continuously monitor the safety of marketed and deployed vaccines in Canada, identify previously unknown APHES, and monitor for any potential signals or frequency or severity of vaccine reactions. From all of this information, this surveillance allows us to take any timely information and action that may need to be taken to protect the Canadian public with regards to vaccines. In terms of where reports come from, we get reports of adverse events similar to VAERS. They come 90% of the time, they come from local and provincial territorial public health agency partners who receive them from healthcare providers such as pharmacists, physicians, nurses. In the past, we also used to receive reports of adverse events from manufacturers, but starting in 2011, legislation actually required that reporting start going towards Health Canada, which is also the pre-marketing approval body, to sort of link the two of them together that way. All that to say, all the reports that we get, the 90% from our provincial territorial partners, as well as any other reports that we happen to come across from manufacturers, are de-identified and placed into CAFIS. And the reports get put through in two streams. We call it enhanced passive surveillance because there is a slight difference in the way it's reported in CAFIS versus in VAERS. I think those of you who are familiar with VAERS, is it's kind of a catch-all, just write what happened, here's the story, and it goes into the database. For CAFIS, there's actually specific tick boxes where we actually try to ask providers to categorize exactly what the reaction was. So that, in essence, kind of tries to standardize the responses that we get somewhat. So it's a bit of, even though it's passive surveillance, it's not just whatever providers feel like writing, but there is some sort of standardization that way. The second part of that the second part of surveillance is another surveillance known as active targeted syndromic surveillance, also known as immunization program active. And this is basically an active syndromic surveillance thing where if there is a severe, usually a neurologic finding at a tertiary pediatric center in Canada, There is a specific nurse practitioner who works with this program who will go and investigate to see if a vaccine had been possibly given up to or just prior to that event occurring. So it's not active surveillance in the sense that we give people vaccines and actively look for cases, but it's more we are actively looking for syndromes and determining if there's a vaccine that had been retroactively related. And then in terms of the APHES, and I should also recognize Jean Nakanza, who's one of the authors and is actually involved in the vaccine safety management at Public Health Agency of Canada as well, and thank you for all your support, obviously, Jean. But essentially, reported APHES are received and processed in a three-step process. The first step is that they're essentially reviewed for accuracy and entered into CAPHIS with initial coding using the Medical Dictionary for Regulatory Activities, known as MedRA. And that's a large part of what Jean does day to day, as well as the first round medical case review, which as a trained health professional, someone like myself or Jean will essentially review the APHE that has been given, assign, determine what the main reason for reporting is, and assign a specific severity to it. Those that are deemed serious will actually be scrutinized again by an expert physician. So this was part of my role as a medical specialist, trying to determine if this associated or this reported adverse event could possibly be, first of all, how certain we are of the diagnosis, and second of all, could it actually be causally related to the vaccine, just to determine if that's something that we want to follow up on. What is a serious thing? So serious criteria, as you've noted there, probably fatal outcomes, permanent disability, any hospitalizations that last than greater than one day, as well as anything that is life-threatening, deemed to be a life-threatening adverse event. And so that goes back to the question of the human papillomavirus vaccine in Canada. So just as a brief refresher for everyone, I'm sure everyone in the room knows that the very first HPV vaccine that came out protected against four strains of HPV, 6, 11, 16, and 18. 16 and 18 specifically are the ones that are related to cervical cancer and genital cancer in cervical cancer in females as well as genital cancer in males. I guess we probably should have proofread that slide a little bit better. But all that to say, In terms of that, the advisory initially in 2006, 7 years ago, was for women aged 9 to 26 years old and was expanded to women aged 45 shortly after that. And in 2011, after, you know, additional evidence that was there, they extended that to men as well. I should mention that these recommendations come from the Canadian version of ACIP. So basically, ACIP, as you're familiar, provides guidance on immunization practices in the United States. In Canada, we have the National Advisory Community of Immunization, which serves a parallel role. I should also mention that we do know that there is another HPV vaccine that is out there. It was only authorized in Canada about 3 years ago and has been quite limited in use due to the way our school-based programs have been, so we've excluded it from this analysis, just based strictly on numbers. And this is a large part of why Cervarix has been excluded. Upon the release of and approval of the initial 4V HPV vaccine in Canada, starting in 2007 up until 2010, pretty much every province in Canada has adopted a school-based human papillomavirus vaccination program at one point or another. You can see there, starting from anywhere in the middle of elementary school all the way to the end of elementary school, grade 8, which is our largest province, Ontario, and is a bit of an outlier compared to the rest of the provinces. All the provinces at present do run a school-based immunization practice. We are actually, from our friends over at Vaccine Preventable Disease Division, we are getting some preliminary numbers with regards to our vaccine coverage rates. Right now, the preliminary numbers suggest that most provinces are somewhere between the 50 to 90% range in terms of coverage for the specific targeted population. So that also suggests that there are a lot of people who've had this vaccine and that these adverse event numbers that are shown here are reflective of, you know, just a general Canadian-wide population. So these are some of the methods. They're very detailed, and I actually originally was not in favor of leaving this slide in just because it is so detailed. Essentially, all we did was we basically took the reports that existed from 2006 to 2012, we cleaned the data, and we essentially analyzed what are sort of different APHES that were seen, what basically going by those category buckets that I'd shown earlier, like how severe things were, We compared it. We compared and calculated rates, and we did additional analyses, subgroup analyses by age group, gender, primary reason for reporting, whether other vaccines were given concomitantly. So, essentially, what you would expect in a general descriptive analysis. So, I'm just going to go ahead to the results, which I think are much more interesting. Like I said, you know, it's like doing vaccine safety, as I mentioned, was kind of like, well, you're kind of like going to a movie where you know what the ending is. But all I have to say is that for the most part, we have found that of 4 million doses distributed in Canada, we only had about 1,369 reports of adverse events. I want to stress again the difference between association and causality. What this means is that of these 1,300 adverse events, they occurred after the vaccine. It doesn't necessarily mean that the vaccine caused them. It's just that they occurred after the vaccine, and they were thus reported as an adverse event following immunization. In the vast majority of these reports, HPV was administered alone. And of the reports, we had 47, which were considered serious. This means that on a reporting rate per 100,000 doses distributed nationwide, we have 34 per 100,000. And serious, we have 1 per 100,000 adverse events following immunization. Again, following immunization, but not necessarily caused by immunization, all those serious events would have probably been looked at specifically for diagnostic certainty and causality. In terms of where we got the reports from, obviously, as I mentioned, for all the reports, the vast majority of them came from our public health partners at the provincial and territorial level. In terms of the serious reports, again, this is where the value of the actively targeted syndromic surveillance system comes into play. As you can see, that red piece of the pie chart there represents the impact surveillance system that is based in our hospitals. And these are some of the patient characteristics for our reports. You will notice that the vast majority of our reports were school-age girls in that age range, 13 to 18 years of age. Of course, because of the nature of the program, 99% of the reports were patients who were female. And so these graphs that you're seeing here basically show you what adverse events following immunization were reported. And you'll notice that of the 1,300, the bottom three there that you'll see, and it's really small, I apologize for the size of the font, but you'll see that says rash, allergic reaction, and vaccination site reaction. So basically these are the typical kind of reactions you would expect to see after immunization. You're talking about things like localized swelling at the injection site, possibly a rash at the injection site, occasionally hives, or just generalized rashes. The rest of these were also broken down in terms of the severity. And you'll see that the most out of all the different categories that we had from our enhanced passive surveillance system, the vast majority of severe reactions were those neurologic events that we actually do monitor for through the pediatric network. And you'll also notice that the vast majority of these events fall very much on the low to moderate impact side of things. I should have mentioned, you know, serious impact we said are things like death, hospitalization, et cetera. Moderate impact is anything that requires someone to just visit a doctor. So if they decided to see a physician after they had the vaccination, had the adverse event, that was classified as a moderate impact, even if they just saw their family doctor once. Again, by age group, you'll notice that for the vast majority of these serious events, there's no specific age group that had a large number of serious events, and the vast majority of them all were lower moderate impact. And this again breaks it. This chart is really complicated, but breaks it down by age group and by the category as well as by severity. So it's kind of like trying to do a few things there. But again, to essentially demonstrate that by age group and the type of reaction, nothing really varied considerably amongst the age group. There wasn't a specific signal that we saw based on the age of the vaccine recipient. Now, some of the more concerning selected adverse events that have been found, particularly published in an Institute of Medicine report, anaphylaxis is the one thing that they were particularly concerned about with HPV. We found a reporting rate of 1.1 per 100,000 doses distributed, which was in line with the rest of the serious events. And you'll notice all these other neurologic events that occurred after the vaccination, you know, things like fetal loss, abnormalities, sudden unexpected death, and also all the neurologic events, as I mentioned, all of them were well less than 1 per 100,000. So this is what is essentially considered less than a de minimis risk, according to most vigilance guidelines. And so how do we compare, or how do things compare? So in the U.S., data from VAERS in 2009 suggested that we're actually on par with what you guys are seeing in the United States somewhat. I will mention that the U.S. rate is significantly higher because for some states they were doing this as a school-based vaccine program for the first time. And I guess in Canada we actually went through a school-based vaccine program in the early 80s where we came up with hepatitis B vaccination in grade 7 students. And shortly after that, one signal that we noticed was a lot of syncope or fainting. And as a result, typically in a school-age population, you have some fainting. So I think it was a similar, the possible explanation for the discrepancy between the U.S. and Canada is that syncope doesn't typically get reported in some Canadian provinces anymore as an adverse event following immunization, whereas for, you know, a novel program in a school-based thing in the U.S., people fainting is something they'd say, oh, they fainted after they got the vaccine. So that's probably one explanation for that difference there. Similarly, rates in Australia per doses distributed were pretty much spot on, right in between where we were. And in New Zealand, they report a bit of a higher rate, but specifically they report by doses administered and not doses distributed. So when you think about doses administered and you actually divide, usually because it's a three-dose regimen, their rates are actually probably somewhat similar to ours as well. All this to say that, at least with regards to 4-VHPV, it seems to be a very safe and well-tolerated vaccine. As we mentioned, I think I mentioned the syncope part there already. The one thing I will mention that has come up recently is that Japan has actually been having an interesting experience with Cervarix, which is the 2-VHPV, one thing that we are watching with interest. There has been a bit of Japanese vigilance has picked up the idea that some people are reporting chronic pain syndrome after receiving Cervarix, and there's obviously more research going on to that. They think it's specifically the adjuvant that's in the Cervarix vaccine that's causing the issue. Again, we don't have enough experience with Cervarix yet to actually comment on that on our end, but it is something that we are watching with interest. So, as I mentioned, this is where, you know, in terms of if we want to promote public health and we want to be out there and say, promoting Gardasil, promoting it as a means to control cervical cancer precursors, as well as genital warts. It's good for us to be able to say, at least from a Canadian perspective, that there is no difference in terms of the safety profile of 4-VHPV as compared to other industrialized countries. We don't have any safety concerns in Canada, and obviously, in the interest of time and the length of this presentation, I will mention a lot of those serious events that were reviewed. Most of the times, uniformly, the causality committee did not feel that the vaccine caused the outcome. And speaking about, you know, some specific cases, it would be someone who, for example, they got the vaccine and then 4 weeks later had a sudden traumatic death, you know, due to a different cause completely. And that would essentially get reported as a serious outcome. So obviously not necessarily caused by the vaccine, but still needs to be reported and properly monitored if we are to be vigilant. And so, as I mentioned, obviously HPV remains a key concern in cervical, penile, and anal cancers and genital warts. But we can at least stand ready from the safety perspective to say that for those people who have concerns, any concerns based on safety are probably we're able to reassure them at this point that we don't have any specific concerns with Gardasil's or 4-VHPV's safety profile, at least from Canadian experiences. So again, I'd like to recognize my co-author Jean for his help, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Yes, could I just have a question, sort of a clarification. Was the school setting was that mandatory or voluntary? Is one question, and also. Given the difference in the healthcare system, could you explain about the cost of the vaccine or whether that was covered?
So actually, it's very ironic that you asked that question because I actually had a slide originally in that looked at the different players of the vaccine, and I think that would have probably helped to tie some of those questions together. So in terms of provincial, so the National Advisory Committee of Immunization, as I mentioned, it actually sets the guidelines. there is a Canadian Immunization Committee, which is the federal government public health agency that works with provincial and territorial public health agencies to determine the cost effectiveness of a potential program. And then the actual programs are rolled out by provincial government health insurance plans. So if the provincial government decides that the health insurance plan is going to cover this vaccine for this specific age group, then it is covered for anyone who is in that province and insured. And in Canada, the way the health insurance works is that if you're a resident in a province, either a permanent resident or a landed immigrant, for more than 3 months, you are actually eligible for health insurance. So basically, a lot of these girls would have been covered and would not have had any cost to the vaccine. With regards to whether it is voluntary or mandatory, for the most part, it is made as an opt-out kind of thing. It's not necessarily mandatory as in, like, you know, you can't. I should say, in certain provinces, it actually varies province to province, just like how in the United States is the federal system. Each province, for example, in Ontario, it is somewhat mandatory in the sense that they have an act called the Immunization of School Pupils Act. So if someone does not get their routine immunizations, public health can issue an order for that person to be suspended from school until such time they decide to formally opt out of it, either due to religious or, you know, conscientious reasons, or they get the vaccine. That does not occur in the province where I'm practicing now, in Vancouver, British Columbia. British Columbia does not have a similar Immunization of School Pupils Act, and so it is a lot more difficult for them to enforce a mandatory program there. So it does vary province to province. Go ahead. So the question is, does making the program school-based make it more acceptable than having it as a clinic-based program? This would probably be answered better for my colleagues from the vaccine preventable side of things, but at least from my background as a public health physician, school-based programs are kind of seen all, the evidence seems suggested there's almost like a collective kind of thing that goes into it, the idea that students are kind of all in this together and that they're all sort of, you know, they support each other through the process, kind of like, oh, one of those things you do at school, right? I think The biggest aspect in Canada was not really the school-based program. At least the difference with the U.S. I would understand is not that it's a school-based program, but it's probably more the fact that the immunization is actually covered a lot of the times, insurance. And at least cost-wise, I understand that the immunization, if you're paying out of pocket, is significantly expensive. So I think if I were to ask my colleagues, they would probably point to the insurance coverage and the cost of the vaccine as being a greater mode for acceptance as opposed to the as opposed to the school-based program itself. So. Sure.
Okay. You showed the incidence of your article and especially the PCR dose problem.
Yes.
Is it possible to compare that with the incidence in the population before that, of those conditions before this vaccine was introduced, to compare whether that was merely the background rate which was accidentally coming up?
So I should mention that in this specific case, the incidence was with regards to like the incidence of the vaccinated population. You certainly could compare the two, but it wouldn't necessarily be a straightforward comparison because I imagine there'd be a lot of other confounders involved in the background of that, just general background rate as well as the actual. I would have to double check that. Yeah. Right.
Using your national health payer, single payer system claim, what are the incidence of the generation
that you're in? It could be something to look at. Using claims data would be hard just because a lot of the times the actual diagnostic code may not actually correspond to the condition that the person had. But it would certainly be an interesting question to look at and one that we may look at as we're putting together the manuscript. It's a very good question. I think, there's an old joke that no other country really is affected by American media outside of America other than Canada. And I think, you know, we have the same issues with regards to anti-vaccination movements, particularly around people like folks like certain celebrities, who I may not mention in this audience. And I think what happens is there is some element of that, but I think at the same time there is certain, I think the almost collective nature of healthcare in Canada makes people a little bit more willing to sort of do their bit. I mean, for example, in the province of Ontario as well, they have a universal flu vaccination program. So anyone can get a flu vaccine, and it's covered by the provincial government. So I think, in general, universal programs are something that Canadians are used to, and it's a question of just making sure that we reassure them with any specific safety concerns they might have. Thank you for the opportunity to present.